lead.
Hey. Oh, this is Bill of Rights. Is Article 1. This is called the First Amendment.
Yeah, this Constitution is back here.
Yeah.
Do you know how much you paid for this?
You can get that from Gene Schroeder.
It's not $50. Is that the thing that's $50?
We had his
you
tape.
Want that?
See, here's a statement here, Dave.
Ian? Well, before when I was expressing to you about using or being addressed with the terminology pro se, my friend here, Mario, he showed me where the judge says, yes, I'd like to rule in your favor, but you have to identify yourself as a pro se before this court. In other words, traverse to a fraud, and then I'll give you your money. which is a sucker punch for a judge. It's kind of stupid, in my opinion. But he's trying to trick the individual into creating the fraud. Once the fraud's been initiated, he'll say, oh, well, there was a defect here now. We're going to sanction you for attorney fees and court costs, probably $25,000 to $50,000 based on the argument that's gone on with this case so far. They did that to me in one of my cases also. They agreed to drop all sanctions against me from the attorneys and dismiss their case, and he dismissed my case also without prejudice. Now, what the judge was doing here was, we'll give him everything he wants, but when he goes to collect it, he'll traverse with the fraud of being addressed as a pro se and a nom de guerre. And we'll nail him the minute he puts his foot out. So you file a notice of refusal for fraud on the court. There is no such thing as a free lunch, folks. Don't bite at the candy when it's stuck out in front of you by these guys. It is not free. This is not justice. When you're in front of a jury trial and the jury comes back and gives you their decision, then you've won the case. Not by any judge saying that he's going to give you it, because I haven't seen a judge's paperwork in the last 1,000 cases that was properly executed. They were highly defective. I mean, on a good day, the lowest defect has been 50 defects in a four-page document. Most of them run 150 to 200 procedural violations within a 4 to 5 page document. I mean, it's that ridiculous that they commit all these different frauds against you. And the tricks and the traps of using these adjectives, adverbs, pronouns, uppercase, nom de guerre, word pro se, person, proper persona, sui juris, using the phrase ETAL, which means what they'll do is they'll try and shortcut. And they'll list the defendants. Let's say you've got 20 defendants. And the attorney comes back and he writes, just, you're only going after a judge and 19 attorneys, all right? So you put the judge's name, put a comma, put ETAL to shorten up listing all the defendants. On any paperwork at any time during the proceedings, from the time you file your complaint, get a notice of refusal, a response, order to show cause, notice of hearing, whatever, that they use this ETAL, either you use it or they use it. And it is accepted. That document is disqualified under a 10A violation. Upon committing a fraud before the court, that portion of the disqualification is removed. Now the procedure is contaminated. They can have their case dismissed if they want to do it, but you don't get your case dismissed, and you win by default because they frauded the court. And you get that through the proper use of common law technology. Now, when you write in a common law name, if you want it to be correct, you put your last name, comma, first, middle. Then what they do is, or you write your first, middle, and last name, upper and lower case, and put a comma after it, But then when you add ETAL, you're saying that the first three words was your last name, and that the next two words, ETAL, is your first name. And if it's not, you've committed a fraud against the court under use of a fictitious name under Title 18, 1342, mail fraud extortion, criminal activity on your paperwork, and a 10A violation. Automatically disqualified, and they can throw you in jail for 5 years for putting ETAL after your name.
Everybody's doing that under regular subject matter
law. Okay, an attorney is licensed to practice, or up until now, he's working inside of the bar. Because he's working inside the, under this bar license, and he's working in a government that is not, in a foreign government does not use federal rules of civil procedure or the Constitution. They make up whatever rules they want. And because the judge is the master, he makes a determination under broad-based discretion as to how his crew is going to function in front of him. If he says ETAL is okay under a foreign government, that's fine. But if you do it as a private citizen or a citizen in party, and your sovereignty will automatically capture the court into a common law scenario, common law jurisdiction. Now he's faced with the rules and regulations under 10A, FRCP 10A, and because they have to follow this, otherwise they violate the Fifth Amendment of due process and the 14th Amendment of due process. If they violate your due process, you cannot have a fair trial under the 6th or a jury trial under the 7th. So you got four constitutional violations there. And those four constitutional violations will automatically activate the 9th Amendment, which says he was supposed to abide by those four in the first place. He's an elected official. He has to support the Constitution. And he didn't do it. And he created this foreign entity under the 11th. I mean, he's breaking every rule in the book. And there's no statute of limitations for this fraud. There's no amount of money you can ask for to represent this fraud, to have your constitutional violations stripped from you, because of the amount of people that have died in wars defending the Constitution, both in the Civil War, Revolutionary War, First, Second, Vietnam, Korea. There's been too much fighting to go ahead and fight for this. And so because of the people who have died, the Congress said there's no amount of money you can ask, no limit to the amount of money you can ask for. Most of the states today have, on personal injury, put limits of $250,000 to $300,000 per injury. Louisiana has a $50,000 limit. I guess they're a poor state. But they're... Pardon? I don't know. They've got, I think California's only got a $250,000 limit on theirs for personal injury. There's a story I tell at seminars. Some of you heard it, some of you haven't. There's a farmer, 1953. It's a true story, by the way. He's plowing his field, and the local sheriff comes down the road. And yells out to the farmer, "I'm going to take your shovel." And the farmer yells back, "You can't have it. I got to shovel my grain with it." The sheriff says, "Well, I'm going to take it anyways." Backs up to the barn, throws a shovel in the trunk, and drives away. The farmer, being poor and simple, walks into his house, and he only had two books to learn how to read from. One was the Constitution of the United States. The other one was Black's Law Dictionary. So he knew what the rules and regulations were and what the definition of the words were. So he knew that the Constitution says that you're not allowed to remove anything without a Fourth Amendment warrant that is worth more than $21. Well, his grain shovel he paid $25 for, so it qualified. So he took a garbage bag, ripped off a corner, wrote the word complaint on the top, put his name as the plaintiff and the sheriff's name as the respondent, and wrote that without due process of law and without a Fourth Amendment warrant, the police officer stole my shovel. That was it. So He then went down to district court, paid his $20 filing fee, at this would have how much it cost back then, and he filed his complaint. And he also put in there in his prayer, "I pray for $1.3 million for having my Fourth Amendment rights violated." It went to the grand jury, and they awarded him $1.3 million for having his shovel taken. True story. You don't need a book this thick to learn how to do a Title 42 or to win a 42. In today's society, with the technology and the frauds that have been created, you need this information to understand how the laws function and the tricks and the traps that are going to pull upon you, because you can write the most beautiful case on paper, stand up in court, and they say, "Are you here appearing pro se?" And you say, "Yeah." "Oh, okay. How much money you got?" "Because we're going to let you argue your case at $150 an hour. Well, this is federal, so you're probably up to $250 an hour. Until your every penny you own is bankrupt or is gone. And then they'll go ahead and they'll say, you committed a fraud back there at day one. And you caused these people to run this big bill up. Now we're going to take your total assets to pay that bill. Because you perpetrated a fraud against the court." They're going to use two sites to get you. Actually, three sites. They're going to use Title 42 USC 1988 under fees. They're going to use the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 11. And they're going to use Title 15, Chapter 1, 15C for fictitious use of, for the frivolous filing of a case. And with these, they're going to order you to pay attorney fees. And you won't have a whole lot of defense from it, because your paperwork will be your worst enemy. In the same scenario, what you learn in this paperwork that you have before you and in the seminar are that the judges and the attorneys, the paperwork that they have filed upon you leaves a track record of what they did and the procedures that they did not follow. You are not going to sue them for what they did. They are immune from what they do. You're going to sue them for what they didn't do. They swore an oath and affirmation to support the Constitution of the United States and for all the constitutional amendments and rules and regulations under titles, which qualify under the codes, the rules and regulations of uniform commercial codes for contracts that they have entered into with these documents, under UCC 3-501, for all the paperwork that they create and the violations that are created within there, you're going to sue them for what they didn't do. And it's very easy, once you know what the tricks and the traps are, to go after all the holes in the cheese, because the cheese is a subject matter, but you're going to sue them for what they didn't do. At all times, private contract supersedes constitutional law. If a judge orders a pretrial conference and he's already joined under common law because he's accepted the case, in other words, you file your paperwork, you've got your American flag and your disclaimer on the front of the papers. He has put his name to the case saying, "I've accepted this case for litigation." Now you're in a common law venue. While up to the time you walk into the sanctuary of the bar, upon entering the sanctuary of the bar is where you must recapture the flag. Now the judge will do everything in his power to get you to walk into his foreign jurisdiction so he can dismiss this case properly, or put you in jail so you can't hurt him and neutralize this case before it has a chance to get a foothold. But this paperwork outlines the procedures. All the judges in the United States have copies of it. They have been studying this material for some 6 months now. They started around July 6, 1995, which is when they started to look at this with some concern. And because of the activities that I have generated in the past 18 months, or 20 months now, they have taken it very seriously, and every time we file a lawsuit now, all the judges have been supplied with telex. It's their inner office communications. It's a closed circuit communications between judges. And as of January 14th, when we filed the treason papers and put Judge Grover on the stand for treason in Shawnee, Wisconsin, all the judges now have taken an extreme close interest, because this is the first time in 200 years that a circuit court judge has stood trial for treason. And so now, Shawnee County didn't want to deal with it, so it's been moved to Federal District Court at 7th District, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And the 7th District Court will have to, because we have 80 signatures on paper to support the charges of treason, have to convict, the U.S. Attorney's going to have to call a grand jury. And this one case will be as important as my Supreme Court cases, and they will have to deal with it. This is not going to go away. Too many. They're running articles weekly up in Shawnee, Wisconsin, at the news. It's the name of the newspaper. It comes out up there. And they're following this close, very closely. They have copies of this document. And there's no way they're going to sweep this under the rug or make it go away. So we'll go get back into the papers here. Turn the page to B1 is a expanded definition outline of B1 and B2 is an expanded definition of what was on the first page there. That was kind of a real quick summary as to what this document, page 2 and 3. Then page 5 is the tricks and traps that they're going to pull on you. It gives you your site numbers on federal, the civil procedure titles and uniform commercial codes, the adjectives, adverbs, pronouns, presumptions, assumptions, and conclusions, and how they are outlined. Now, this page 5 was adapted by the United States Supreme Court on September 18, 1996.
What page is that?
Is that
A1?
5. Page 5. Page 5.
What does it say at the top?
It says 11-896, instructions written by David Miller. The errors that the Supreme Court may have charged you with. What's that?
It says 1 on the bottom here.
Oh, you were supposed to renumber your book. The way I had it clipped together, so that
it's our page 2, page 5.
Page 2.
Page 2.
We may be missing some pages because it's page 2 on what we have.
Page 2.
You've got copyright 2197.
Yeah.
2197, right. Page no, that's two. The first page.
Yeah, no, but the second page.
Oh, you were supposed to renumber everything.
Well, no, but.
Oh.
You see what
it
I'm
was
saying?
In the order in the book here.
Oh, you got one that got mixed up, that's all.
Well.
This here is the one I just. This was 2 and 3, and that was 5, and this is 6.
Okay. But I think they're all this way.
Yeah. No, it's 75.
When we go to a page, if you...
All right, what I'll do is I'll just hold it up and show it to you, and then you can realign it.
Read the top line of that.
Yeah, okay.
11-896.
Well, I've titled this page C1, so that... We're gonna go through the alphabet and put alphabet numbers on top. So when you guys call me at my house, you'll say, "I was at your seminar, and I'm talking about document number J." Okay, and that way I know which document we're working with.
So right now we're on page 2. That starts off.
No, not page 2.
Yeah, it's 2 by me and you, but it's something else.
Oh, you guys mixed them up. Some of it. All right, it's adjectives, adverbs, and pronouns. All right.
No, I don't think that's right.
Well,
and you marked it at C1.
On top, yeah, I marked that C1. On the top, you've got your...
your telephone number at home?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, I'll have to realign my book. Well, it's only the first five pages that you're going to get mixed up. The first five pages are just procedures, okay? They tell you about the adjectives, adverbs, pronouns, and the tricks and the traps.
It starts out with 11-896 instructions written by David Quinn Miller.
Yeah, that's the second page.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
11-896.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
That's actually page 2 in the book. Wait.
2197. That's what I got.
All right, you guys change your numbers or do whatever you want.
What number is it?
You got to read it all anyways. That isn't that. That's just that. These are just your procedure outlines. Those first five pages. Oh, yes, it's just the first five pages. Everything else is big documents. You won't get lost. Just the facts, right. Now, when the Supreme Court adapted these procedures, I was there with the Carroll case here was the one that went in. Was the case that got filed on that day, on September 13th. That was Friday the 13th. And these were the guidelines to read this book. Because I knew the Supreme Court didn't deal with my procedure, hadn't seen my procedure yet, the way it was laid out, I had to build an instruction sheet to read this book. Because there's no subject matter in this book. I went to the Supreme Court 2 weeks earlier and I looked at the cases that were filed. I brought one here as an example. But when I started reviewing the cases that were on file there, they were all subject matter cases in the United States Supreme Court. Cannot hear subject matter cases. Not only that, they get 7,100 cases a year to disqualify 7,000 to keep 100. The cases that they were keeping were subject matter cases. The cases that they were disqualifying were subject matter cases. They were keeping cases that were as close to a constitutional intent to violate as possible. Now, when I went there, the clerk says, there's only two ways you can file a case here in the United States Supreme Court. You either have to be an attorney licensed at the Supreme Court or you must be a pro se. I says, well, I refuse that statement for fraud. I'm a citizen party. I said, you're going to have to reprogram your computers so that it reflects a citizen and party filing a lawsuit in this court as it's guaranteed to me under the Constitution, under a writ of error. That if the lower courts make a mistake, that only procedural violations and statutory violations can be filed in U.S. Supreme Court. And I had Black's Law Dictionary, first edition. I showed it to him. She says, you're absolutely correct. I said, this is a subject matter case. You've got noun-verb combinations on here. You've got adjectives, adverbs, and pronouns, and conclusionary law sites listed in this document. I said, it's all a violation of the Fifth Amendment due process. And so she took the case that I brought here, and she says, well, this case is disqualified then, which already had been approved. They then took, starting September 13th, and reprogrammed the computer that does the reading of the cases and looking for all the different procedural violations within the document. It's got character analysis identification, and that's how they do it. They type all the stuff in they got a scanner that scans the document, reads the material electronically, and then disqualifies the cases if they don't conform to what the case is before the courts. The computer is programmed to identify sentence structure violations. In other words, subject matter. But the cases that they were approving were also equally subject matter. So on September 13th, which was the first day of the Jewish New Year, 1996, which was Friday 13th, it was foretold that this would be the beginning of the end for the de facto government. And 5 days later, they adapted these procedures and disqualified the 1,500 cases, which represented a 12-and-a-half-year wait for my case to be heard in the United States Supreme Court. And it bumped everybody out of the way so my case could get up there and get heard. And my case deals with perjury of oath and constructive treason against the Constitution. Two subjects that have never been tested in the United States in 200 years. Under the rules of the Supreme Court, a unique case cannot be disqualified no matter how badly it's written if the subject matter brought before the court has never been tested before. Well, I've got double qualifications on that. The third qualification is that if you have more than five people in your case, it's a complex case. And a complex case incorporates conspiracy. Again, can't be disqualified. Because I'm suing the judges under the jurisdiction of a Title IV USC 1 flag and have qualified this case under Article 1, Section 9, Chapter 8 of the Constitution, they can't take it into a foreign jurisdiction. They have to try it under common law, and they have to try it, they have to try themselves as well, because they themselves are guilty of the same crime of using a gold fringed flag as all the other judge courts in the United States. So to find anybody guilty, they've got to find themselves guilty, which is a very unique situation. More than likely, this case will wind up on the floor of the Senate or in Congress for deliberation, because it creates what's called a writ of error coram nobis. It means the judge must rule upon his own decision, and he himself is named as a plaintiff or is a defendant, which makes it a catch-22. He can't find anybody guilty unless he finds himself guilty, and whatever penalty he passes down on anybody else, he has to pass down on himself.
Congress is guilty too.
Yeah. Congress, the legislature, right, the whole entire structure under this de facto flag. So Congress would have to, before they hear the case, declare amnesty, hear the case under the rules of discovery, not as a trial case, and from the rules of discovery, declare amnesty for the whole entire scenario, and then remove the yellow fringe flags. Otherwise, they still have to be tried for treason. All of them. Every state, every congressman, every senator, anybody that does an oath and affirmation that walked into a yellow fringe flag and infringed upon a citizen's rights at any time in his career would be guilty of treason, constructive treason. And there's no way around it. And you sue them for what they didn't do. They didn't uphold the Constitution, the very first contract they made when they became public officials. There's no remedy for this thing. And that's what makes this material so sensitive.
When do you think it will be heard?
Well, in 1864... The black man was freed. Congress goes ahead and he says, okay, we have a 3/5 person under the 14th Amendment. And they discriminate against a 3/5 person in certain areas. There's not slavery, but he doesn't have privileges. So 100 years later, you've got 35 million people standing in front of the courthouse, and by the sheer weight of a bad law, the United States Supreme Court and Congress passes the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Article 7, abolishing the 3/5 person of the 14th Amendment, and now has equal protection for all citizens. I had a friend of mine who didn't know the law had been passed and spent 25 of the next 35 years in jail on over 28 contempt charges. That was a tragedy. Because he didn't find out about it until the spring when he met with me and he got into a debate, still believing that a 3/5 person was relevant and he wasn't going to become part of it until I showed him the law. And he sat there and he cried. because he had destroyed his entire family, life, and career, arguing for something that already had been abolished.
It's difficult to make that change for some individuals.
With the a right not used, the right sacrifice. So, education is very powerful. This document is knowledge. And the first rule of responsibility is you must be responsible to responsibility. If you study this material, you have the technology and the knowledge to put people in jail for life, to destroy people with this stuff. They may be guilty of what they did. They may not have the will of intent for what they did. They may not know of the will of intent they had committed as far as a criminal act goes by using a yellow fringe flag. So you have to be responsible to the people that you go before with this technology as to how hard you want to push it. Because when you're talking about removing somebody's, putting somebody in jail for life, destroying their family, their children, their reputations, and they have nothing to lose, you may lose. They may come out and kill you. So this technology is very important, as well as you have to be responsible to it. And you got to pick your battles. Do not do this alone. The best security you have is you get yourself a study group. You get yourself, I always say a minimum of five people get involved. First, find out in your community who else needs the help and get them together in a study group so that you're all working together. If one of you puts a person, all five of you put it together. When you file this lawsuit, make very sure that the person, or that the party that you are naming in it, is absolutely guilty of what he is being charged with. Because these things will absolutely destroy somebody. So you must be responsible for this. And when you take these and you file them with the clerk, file them at the newspaper, take them down and file them with the bond companies. You get the name of the bond company from the city treasurer. The treasurer is responsible for the disbursement of tax money. If the county or city that you're suing, or state for that fact, you can't sue a state, but if you have state actors, you go to the treasurer, and the treasurer will tell you who the bond company is, because they have the public record that underwrites the insurance for the city, state, and county. Now, once you know that, you serve the bond company with the Title 42. They cannot insure fraud. The bond company will do the necessary liens against the insurance company, who will then put the liens against the pension funds, the insurance policies, the bond that are held, savings accounts, home mortgages, cars, whatever money has been extorted as a result of fraud, they will put a lien against it. So that if you're asking for $25 or $50 million in a lawsuit, that you're going to get your due, your day in court, and that you're going to get paid. And everybody gets shut down until they sit down and settle with you. So the defensive posture usually ends almost immediately if they're trying to sue you for something to put you in jail. Or even if you are in jail, the city government shuts down until you're released, until this thing is brought to a resolution. Yes. Right, risk management is the name of the company that underwrites the bond or the insurance or whatever municipalities, and this is in all 50 states.
But you're assigned to a bond company, and they get the risk management. Is that what you do? Assigned to a bond, or
well, you can call up risk management is the name of the organization that lists all of the bond companies that are under their wings, so to speak, and then you can get the name of the municipality that has policy with them, or you can go to the city treasurer and get the same information. And under the Freedom of Information Act, they can deny you this information.
What about
same thing, Freedom of Information Act. Your tax, if taxpayers' money being spent and you're a taxpayer, you have a right to know where your tax money is going.
Well, you sell to a bond company that covers the state?
Well, states are all 50 states are self-insured.
Are they?
Yes.
Okay.
But they still sell bonds.
Okay.
A lot of times, even under a public records request, they won't answer, you know, under government code 6230.
Well, they,
you're
fighting a paper trail, but if you go there in person, you're right in front of them.
To file band-aid against them, you know, you can get them, they cough it up.
Well,
under 1460, they're required by law to give you a copy of any bond they have.
Yeah, but if they won't do it.
Well,
all right. There's multiple ways to go around this. You can contact the Securities and Exchange Commission and has a list of every bond company in the United States. The Securities and Exchange Commission has access to the Treasurer and access to all the listings. So you can find out one way or another. So Securities and Exchange Commission can call the Secretary of State and get information under the Open Records Act. And if you have if you're dealing in stocks and bonds when you have an account, your agent will be the person to get that information for you. Mailing address, the whole thing. But once you drop one of these Title 42s in the hands of a bond company, they will move up on it. Now, in West Bend, Wisconsin, we had a friend of mine got placed in jail, and he refused to identify himself to the court because it was a military court-martial. He attempted to take an American flag to court with an American flag, and the bailiff stole his flag away from him, and then physically handcuffed him and drug him into the court so he'd be in this foreign jurisdiction and put him in jail. So they acted with collusion, assault, kidnapping. They violated every rule. Because of those actions that took place, a Title 42 for constructive treason was placed on the city and filed with the bond company. The bond company then locked down the city of West Bend. They couldn't even take the fire trucks out or the police cars out until they settled this matter. They put liens against the pension funds of the police department, the bank accounts of the judges and the attorneys involved, and every police officer in the city had his checking account, savings account, put liens against, and paralyzed the entire government with a $70 million lawsuit. That's more money, 10 times more money West Bend's got. Upon file, they then came to my friend, and they gave him a FRCP 41A voluntary withdrawal. They would vacate all charges against him and pay him restitution in exchange to drop the lawsuit so they can get the city government back online. That's the kind of power this thing has. And somebody says, well, did he win? doesn't take years. He had it done in 10 days.
Wow.
And he didn't want anything to do with West Bend, so he moved down to Indiana, got out of state, left the state. I mean, he settled his accounts, and then he left the state. He was in fear of his life from all the people that were pissed off at him from West Bend. But these documents are very, very powerful. We had a man in Los Angeles, Orange County. He was Mexican. He was driving he owns a dealership, had his dealer's license plates on his car. He was arrested and placed in jail for not having city driver's city plates on the car. He's not required to. The case ran through 5 hearings, and it drug on for 9 months. It went to jury trial, and he was found guilty under an admiralty jury and sentenced to 5 years in prison for driving a car that he owned, because he owned the dealership with dealer's licenses on. To give you an idea how prejudicial the system is working, the day before sentencing, which was on Tuesday, he filed the treason papers. The judge, upon walking in the court, says, in my chambers now, in half an hour, apologize. ordered the bailiff to vacate all computers in the courthouse of any existence of this man in the case. Physically went around, picked up every piece of paper, every file, completely purged the system, dismissed all charges against him after his jury found him guilty. It was a stacked jury. He confessed to the man. He was under orders to put as many people in jail because of the $38,000 a year that the state of California would get kickbacks from the federal government, and apologized to him, "Don't sue me for treason." He says, "This will destroy my life, and we have no remedy from this technology." That night, they threw a party with 20 of his family members in celebration of Dave Miller Law Procedure.
Maybe we got
does the system work? Yes, it works. We had another man in Seattle, Washington, was the same thing. Was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Candidates to the judge was dismissed instantly. His case, they vacated the whole thing. Another man in Sullivan up in Vermont. He's been in the newspaper. Highly publicized case. He has a reporter up in Vermont that has taken an interest in this technology. And he has a column on the front page of the newspaper up there. And he has been following the corruption of the court in this case. For bringing a flag into court, he was sentenced to 3 months in a psych ward because he's for psychiatric evaluation. We had him released in 3 weeks with a Title 42, and he's gone to 5 other hearings since then, at which time they have now filed, as of Monday this week, the treason papers on the judge, and everybody in government is treating him just, they're bending over backwards to make this man comfortable in every capacity, and he expects the case to be vacated before the week's out, where he gets all of his restitution that he's asked for. But this has been a very screwy scenario. I personally, when I had my case in Shawnee, used this technology, and they vacated the case, gave me back my bond money, gave me back my jury trial money. Jury fees aren't refundable. They still gave them back to me. And they made this whole thing go away. And then we filed the counterclaim papers in Shawnee County. We took them in file stamp and says, "This case has been vacated already, sir. We can't accept the papers." He says, "We'll take them and put them in the file." And then I called, that same day, I called the attorney of record for the defendants in Green Bay. And he said it's his first time in his career he's gotten all of the papers back that he has filed with orders from the court in Shawnee that the case has been vacated. They're discharged, and they won't accept papers from their own attorney. He says this technology that he was reading, he says it was somewhat surprising to him because he's never seen anything like it, and he didn't know really how to approach it. I says, "Well, you know, the paperwork you sent me was mail fraud extortion." He says, "I don't know what that means." So I explained to him about nom de guerre and Title 18, 13, 42. I says, "If I want to push it in federal court," I says, "you personally will be facing 5 years in jail under a federal charge of mail fraud, as you have asked for attorney fees." He says, "Oh, don't worry about that." He says, "There's no, we're not asking for attorney fees." He says, my clients and I, we just wanted to make this a non-issue." So they're already scrambling for cover and to make this thing go away. That attorney, by the way, I am going to be working with. And he seems to have patriotic overtones. Because in our conversation, I said to him, I says, "You know, if you learn this technology," I says, "you can practice common law as an attorney." I says, "And the judges have no power to stop you." He says, "Oh, no." He says, "If I go into court with a common law case," he says, "I'll lose my license to practice." I says, "If the judge takes away your license, he goes down for treason." I says, "Now you tell me what a judge is going to do. He's not going to touch you for anything, because you..."